first and foremost, it's got to be accurate before it is anything else.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Well, thank you guys so much for tuning in. This is a little bit different of an episode. As you know, most of the time we have a guest. Occasionally, Steve and I will do a show on our own, which we're doing this week. But in a way, Steve is also the guest. So we're talking about broadheads. Specifically, we're looking at what makes a broadhead perform well in terms of penetration, accuracy, durability, those aspects. We're going to get into flight and tuning more in our next episode, so stay tuned for that. But this one's specifically about broadhead and broadhead design. Some of you may know that Steve actually designed his own broadhead and had a broadhead company for a while. So he's a great resource to talk with in terms of design aspects on broadhead and how that affects performance. So this is a good episode. Again, we talk specifically about broadheads, design, accuracy, penetration, those aspects. Next week, join us, kind of a part two for this discussion. We speak with Darren Cooper, who's an archery guru, and we talk more specifically about what we need to do in terms of arrow building, bow tuning, and things like that to get the best broadhead flight possible. So again, these two episodes are going to be great, should be really helpful for you as you go about evaluating broadhead choice and then getting your bow to shoot that broadhead most accurately. As always, guys, thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate your feedback. Hope you enjoy this episode. Steve, what's going on? It's time to talk broadheads, man. You ready for this?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. Broadheads is something I'm definitely passionate about. I think most guys, everyone tries a lot of different broadheads, but it is, outside of fletching and arrow and your bow and everything, it is the actual item that does the killing. So I think in the past, that's something that's been overlooked by a lot of people. Traditionally broadheads have always been cheap, because they kind of considered disposable. But if you really look at it, you look at all the hours, all the effort, everything that goes into, bow hunting, it all comes down to that broadhead impacting that animal. And that's, that's gotta be the most critical thing, critical piece of gear that you've got, with you.
Yeah. It's the point of contact. It is the physical connection between you and the animal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I can't believe it's taken us this long. This is episode 120 something, and why in the world did it take this long to do broadheads? That's so funny.
Yeah, no kidding.
So yeah, we want to talk about broadheads themselves. We'll kind of hit on categories. We'll certainly talk about some of our experiences. It's one of these deals now where in this market with broadheads, gosh, we can't talk about every model out there by any means. So we're going to talk a bit more high level and then kind of mention some specifics and how that plays out for us. But I'm sure a bunch of guys are familiar with your background. But man, we have so many listeners, newer listeners at this point. You have some broadhead experience. So go ahead and tell us about that. What led you to starting Solid? What was Solid? How did that whole thing go down?
I think what led me to starting Solid, Solid Broadhead Company, was not any different than what led Lenny and I to start Exo Mountain Gear, was just not satisfied with what we were using and seeing on the market. You kind of go through this evolution of just trying stuff and not being satisfied, or you find something that's close, but it's got like one or two little drawbacks that kind of hold you back. It was back, right when I started SNS Archery. So 2008-ish, I was super, super gear junkie, diving into my bow. I was building like custom bows. I was playing around, literally taking risers and cams and limbs from different bow companies and mixing and matching. And so super, super techie, playing with all that stuff. And then broadheads was no exception. I was constantly doing testing, shooting through wood and steel and ballistics gel, and just never could find the perfect broadhead for me. And that, you know, most people listening are in a state that you can shoot mechanicals. Idaho is one of the few that has to be fixed blade. So I had to be shooting fixed blade. So I was stuck with that parameter. And yeah, just for whatever reason or another, you know, I always felt like that it could be improved on. I had no broadhead designing experience other than just testing, you know, literally hundreds of different brands and models. And had a good idea in my head of what I wanted to build, and basically set out to do it. Found a local company that I could work with. You know, I had was able to sketch out some designs, and I had some AutoCAD experience from my past construction history. So I was able to kind of draw some stuff up, and then found a company that was able to do the machining and kind of polish it up. And yeah, it was a pretty cool experience. It happened pretty dang fast. I think in a matter of like 6 months, took that thing from something in my head to a product that was for sale, which was, you know, crazy. I no longer own Solid. I had a very good relationship with the owner from Elite Archery, and they approached me pretty early on about buying it. And heck, I was like 24 at the time, and it's like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, you know? So I ended up selling the company within the first year. So yeah, that was my experience with it. It was, you know, it's still, in my opinion, from a performance standpoint, one of the best broadheads on the market. It's very much so expensive broadhead, though. So they're like 100, and since the Outdoor Group owns them now, they raised the price to like $130 for three of them. So it's, to me, if I was the average, you know, average Joe out there, it's a phenomenal broadhead. Probably wouldn't take it into the woods behind the house and shoot whitetails with. It's probably a little overkill for that. But if you're on, like, you're going to Alaska for your once in a lifetime moose hunt, or, you know, something along those scenarios, big game, heavy game, phenomenal choice. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's funny. Cause we obviously wasn't working for EXO back then, cause EXO didn't exist back then, but we kind of knew each other a little bit. And I remember, getting some super early, kind of like samples of the broadhead, and was just blown away when I shot them.
Yeah.
Actually, it's funny. There's I think I have a video on YouTube. It's probably from like this, I think the super early, I mean, it's been a good 6 or 7 years now from when that video is out there. And I literally on camera, first take, I shot a Solid broadhead and a Field Point at 70 yards, and they were like an inch apart. And I was like, this looks like it's made up on video, but it was like legit first take. It was so funny.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I mean, well, we're going to get into talking about design, but you know, one of the, we talk about your first point of contact with the animal, having a broadhead that flies well is absolutely critical, right? Like that's, you know, I think first and foremost, it's gotta be accurate before it is anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely talk a bit about that. I'm curious, just to backtrack, if you weren't in Idaho, would you be considering mechanicals at all? I mean, I've played with a bunch. I can shoot them, obviously, here at home. Even, you know, in states like Colorado, I could shoot them for elk hunting. But I've just stuck with fixed for probably reasons that we'll talk about. But I'm just curious if you are kind of interested in mechanicals at all, if you weren't there in Idaho or maybe going out of state on another hunt, do you see an advantage to mechanicals?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I have, I've hunted out of Idaho and I haven't bothered to switch to a mechanical. I definitely wonder if my experience or any if things would be different had I lived in Utah where you can shoot them. You know, I don't know if I ever would have started Solid. So, I think we talked about this recently on a podcast, so maybe that one hasn't aired yet, but I think you could very, very easily argue, like the state of Idaho, I could go down there and pitch a very good argument for mechanicals. And that argument would be strictly, you know, you could bring in a bunch of pro shop owners that deal with people tuning or help people tune their bows, right? A mechanical is going to fly better out of an untuned bow or a bow that's just barely out of alignment than a fixed blade would. And that's assuming, you know, that's assuming a lot of things, that it's a well-designed mechanical with a low profile. And I mean, there are some really gigantic ones out there that, you know, aren't going to fly good, but, you know, all things being equal, a mechanical just has a less surface area in the front of it, like a field point, or it's closer to a field point than a big fixed blade broadhead, and it's just going to fly better. So if accuracy is the most important thing when that arrow leaves your bow and is headed towards where you're aiming, then I think you could go, okay, a lot more animals are going to die because people are going to actually hit where they're aiming, versus if you have someone who doesn't take the time to really get their bow tuned, and they shoot a fixed blade and it's erratic, you know, it's like 3 inches left one day and 4 inches high and right the next day, then that animal's going to get wounded. So it's kind of like, what's the lesser of two evils here? Yeah. Idle Fishing Game is basically saying that mechanicals are going to fail and you're going to put a field point through an animal. And I think, heck, if when you get into those online forum arguments about all the different broadhead designs, at the end of the day, a field point through the heart and lungs of an elk is going to kill it. I can't imagine it's going to live. So that's, to me, that's the worst case scenario. So if I was, you know, again, quote unquote, average Joe, didn't have bow tuning equipment, didn't really know what I was doing there, just go to my pro shop, buy a bow, go home, shoot it. You know, you shoot, you know, you're a dozen or so times before hunting season. Hopefully you're doing more than that, but you go out, I think that guy is better suited with a mechanical, because it's going to be a little more forgiving for you. But if you're a guy who loves to tune, loves to dive into all that stuff, then there's some serious advantages to a fixed blade. So
yeah, it's definitely not it's black and white, you know, as some would like it to be.
Because,
I mean, it's interesting, obviously, as exactly what you just mentioned, a mechanical is going to have some accuracy advantage unless everything is completely dialed, including the bow and the shooter, I think. Mm-hmm. But then there's a little bit more, you know, issue maybe with performance potentially, just depending on where and how you contact an animal, especially if you're talking a big animal like elk and larger bone structure and things like that. So yeah, there's like all these issues that go into this, for sure. I think in the end, if you are super passionate about archery hunting, I think if nothing else, it is helpful to know enough about your bow and your arrow and your form to be able to shoot a fixed blade well and have that ability if that's what you want to do. Mm. And I think there's hunts, animals that are probably, you know, better suited, at least with margins of error for a fixed blade. So it's an interesting point for sure to discuss. That's not what we're going to spend all of our time on today. But just we'll mention as well, as we talk about kind of the accuracy, maybe some of the bow aspects, arrow setup aspects, that's going to be next episode. We've actually already talked with Darren Cooper about getting excellent broadhead flight. So guys, stay tuned for part two if you want to kind of talk more about the bow aspect and the arrow aspect and get into things like fletching and drag and downrange accuracy with broadheads. We're not going to get there today, but I'm curious, just on the broadhead itself, you mentioned accuracy is obviously a critical element. Would completely agree. What are some of the things that you were looking at when you developed Solid, for example, or some of the things that you look at if just looking at broadheads on the market? Again, at this point, just speaking fixed blades, mm-hmm. What goes into accuracy with a fixed blade broadhead for the broadhead itself?
Yeah, basically it's just aerodynamics. It's the exact same conversation that we had with Darren on fletching, right? Like the more surface area in fletching, the better as a general rule. On the front of your broadhead, the front of your arrow, the least amount of surface area and associated drag that's created by that is better. So if a good thing would be like, look at a broadhead, like point it, you know, have it screwed on the arrow and point it straight at your eye and look down that and make sure that everything is very, very smooth. If you take a solid and look at it from the front, it's like the blades just barely stick out, but the ferrule portion of it, they're all smooth transitions right into the arrow. There's not any abrupt edges. There's not any rough edges. And I think that's, it is the leading point going through the air downrange to your target. And it just has to be, that arrow just has to pass over it, just like butter. Or a hot knife through butter, whatever. and so that's the biggest thing. If a broadhead, two things you're looking at, like cutting diameter, obviously that's going to be more blade up front. It's going to, it's just like a taller vein. That's going to grab more air, as well as length. So a short compact broadhead, is a very, is going to fly better than one that's an inch and a half long. Unfortunately there's a million, there's part of the reason I designed Sol is you get a short compact broadhead, but then it's going to have steep blade angles, and a steep blade angle is going to reduce your penetration, right? Because it's instead of kind of slicing through the animal, it's more of a blunt impact. So there's all these pros and cons and trade-offs, but as far as flight goes, really you can just look at surface area and tell that one's going to fly good or not. There are exceptions to that, but as a general rule, I would definitely say, a nice short compact broadhead versus like a three blade, take an old school NAP or Muzzy broadhead. Those things were about 1.5-2 inches long, big blades on them. That is just not going to fly as good as a Slick Trick, right? Mm-hmm. That's short and compact. So that's kind of you could pretty much just look at that and tell some are going to do better than others. Now, unfortunately, you can go down a wormhole here, and I've been down it a million times with people over the phone or something like that, talking about tuning broadheads. There are, if your bow or your form is slightly out of whack, you may screw on a bigger broadhead, more surface area, and it's actually counteracting your bow being out of tune. So as you shoot, it's correct, whatever flaws in the broadhead is correcting the flaw in your form, and it's kind of hitting your point of impact at 20 yards. And I've seen that happen quite a few times.
Yeah, it's almost like that steering power, and so it's exactly steering to overcorrect something else. It's covering up something else that's actually going on.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, too, to look at cutting diameter. I'm interested in, looking down the point of a broadhead, you could have this larger diameter. Maybe it's a two blade, three, four, what have you, but you have this larger cutting diameter, but that doesn't necessarily always equate to surface area when you look at the cross section of a broadhead. So basically, you could have a large cutting diameter, but those blades are very vented, therefore they have a less cross directional surface area, or you could have smaller blades, but they're solid. There's no ventilation there. There's a greater amount of surface area there. Something on the solid broadhead itself, just to talk about that one as an example, especially just kind of the standard 100 grade, there's a lot of ventilation built into that. You had a lot of cutouts in that, especially in the original design. So I'm thinking that reduction of cross surface area, is that another key point to accuracy there, is reducing that type of surface area?
Yeah. You can definitely just do an equation of add up the total surface area on the broadhead and basically any surface, and add that all together. And that's going to translate into what your flight looks like. Another thing I also found through developing that was surface area kind of as a general rule equals penetration. So if you've got, I was testing some older, two blade, broadheads that are, 3 inches long and solid metal. When you shoot through, it's always hard. You can't say definitively on an animal what this is going to do, but when you shoot through foam, when I shot through wood, stuff like that, all that extra surface area was just grabbing and slowing the broadhead down. So it reduced penetration. The exact same principle applies as it's going through air. If that's a big solid blade, it's just grabbing that air the entire way downrange, and it's just going to be more critical of tune, more critical of form issues, more critical of a crosswind coming in, all the above.
Yeah, I always think about the Surfacer and flight, the things you just mentioned, crosswind, etc. But I didn't necessarily think of surface area in terms of penetration, but it makes complete sense. The greater the surface area, the more contact with the bone, the flesh, what have you, within the game. Yep. Therefore, it's slowing down, more friction, less penetration.
Yep.
Yeah. Huh. That makes super sense.
Yeah. And then the next thing I, along with while we're on that line, is always, you always want a ferrule that is slightly larger than your arrow shaft diameter. So that once you punch that initial hole through, then the arrow shaft, especially if you say you go through heavy bone, the arrow shaft is just following it and is not bigger or even equal. Cause then that's just going to be able to grab the bone as well.
Yeah. The broadhead's cutting the path. It's leading the way. It's clearing a path for the arrow to pass through with as little friction as possible.
Yep. Yeah. But it's, specifically look at the ferrule should have like a little bump in it.
Right.
So, cause the blades could just slice through the bone. But if the ferrule isn't actually opening up a hole, then the arrow shaft can still definitely grab onto it.
Any other things that come to mind, with accuracy that we can kind of, you know, I'm just thinking of listeners looking at evaluating broadheads.
Yeah. One thing that even kind of surprised me to this day that I see guys not know about is spinning a broadhead. And there's two things here. One, a long, tall broadhead, say one that's an inch and a half long versus, I'll just keep using Slick Trick. They're super short. They're probably like 3/4 of an inch or an inch. If there's any misalignment, so when you screw the broadhead into the tip of the arrow, if your insert isn't put perfectly square into the arrow, if the end of your arrow isn't square, which that can be easily fixed with like that G5 arrow scoring device, or if your broadhead was machined or, you know, built slightly out of alignment, when you screw it all together, all I simply do is put it on a tabletop and spin it and watch. You're just staring at the connection of the broadhead to the tip of the arrow. So if that's your insert or in my case, I'm using the Easton Deep 6. So it's just the tip of the aluminum or the very end of the arrow. Just watching that point and making sure there's no wobble. It should spin like a top, right? Like you spin it and it just goes and goes and goes and goes. If there's any wobble in there at all, that basically is telling you that, like, imagine the fletching on the back end of your arrow, if it was like all completely at a different angle and misaligned, right? Like if your broadhead, you know, basically fletching on the front of your arrow isn't perfectly in line and kind of in all the axes with the arrow shaft, as it goes down range, it's going to do all sorts of funky stuff. So you could have everything perfect. You could have perfect form, perfectly dialed in bow, perfectly tuned bow, perfect arrow spine, all the above. And you just screw one broadhead on there that's just slightly misaligned. You shoot and you could have, like, you know, at 20 yards, you could miss 6 or 8 inches left. That's easily happenable. So you definitely, every time you screw an arrow in, you got to make sure that you spin that or screw a broadhead in. Make sure you spin it. It's something I'm always checking while I'm out in the field too. Like I'll take my number one arrow out of my quiver if I'm just sitting there, and I'll just spin it on like on my quiver, some flat, smooth surface I can find on my bow, just to make sure that it hasn't gotten bent while I was, you know, out there in the field messing around. And then, so to go along with that, imagine a short broadhead, right? If it's misaligned versus a long broadhead, if it's misaligned, that is going to be a drastic difference if they're both misaligned equal, if that makes sense, right? Like just because the tip of that broadhead is further away from the end of the arrow, any little bit is going to be exaggerated on a longer broadhead.
Right. Yep. Yeah. If you're 1 degree off and travel 1 foot, it's different than being 1 degree off and traveling 1,000 yards.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's before, you know, there's been times when I guess, you know, I don't know if I just didn't spin or what, but there's been times where I've frustrated myself with tuning, for example, and I'm like, let me just try a different arrow. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
sure enough, that broadhead, yeah, on that arrow was not happy, whether that, yeah, was slightly out of square or just the threading, you know, didn't grab, whatever, yeah, that was. It's, yeah, just always important to keep in mind of, like, if you're having troubles, spin, but then also just verify, like, let me try another broadhead or another arrow combination, because sometimes, you know, crap happens. I've built what I've felt like have been really consistent arrows, especially you know, the more that I've learned and the more that I've dialed in that process. And still, for some reason, I'll find a combination of a really, really good broadhead that I know is great and a arrow that was built very carefully. And sometimes it even appear to spin pretty good, but for whatever reason, you know, just don't get as good a flight as I will with others. So it's always a helpful point to keep in mind.
Yeah. One thing along those very same lines is, and I'm preaching this, but I don't really always practice it, is number your arrows.
Yeah.
And then that way you can track, like if number four is always hitting differently than the rest, that way you can track it. And then always broadhead tune and everything with like two or three arrows. Like don't have one field point and one with a broadhead and just be shooting that. Like I'd have, you know, one or two field points and two or three broadheads and see, you know, make sure that you're getting consistent grouping out of it before you go and make adjustments to your bow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the arrows that make it into my quiver for hunting have usually earned their place there. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I'm curious, I have a, you know, list of points that I kind of want to hit and talk about, but where would you just kind of default to go after accuracy? What comes to mind as being up there with importance? What are you looking at with a broadhead?
Yeah, so accuracy, number one. Number two is going to be penetration.
Okay.
I think penetration overrules cutting diameter on... You know, I think on Western, well, on all game, but specifically Western big game, right? Like they're going to be longer shots. They're bigger animals. They're heavier boned. I think, you know, maybe if I was hunting whitetails and most of your shots are 20 yards or less, things just become a lot less critical, thinner skin, smaller bone, et cetera. But yeah, penetration is number one. I want, to me, two small holes is better than one big hole. So if that means I can get a complete pass through and have 2 1-inch holes, then I've got 2 inches of cutting, of bleeding coming out both sides. Versus if I shot a broadhead with an inch and a half cutting diameter and I only got into one side, then I only have an inch and a half. So, and it's always, if you know, anybody's out there has ever done a blood trail, if it's coming out both sides, that is a heck of a lot easier to follow than if it's just dripping down the front left leg. So to me, that is definitely number two on the list. And the problem that you have is there's just so many different scenarios when you hit that animal of, you know, if it's a quartered away shot and you go in behind that last rib, man, you could throw a freaking 3-inch broadhead through that thing and probably still come out the other side. But you have to plan for worst case scenario, and that's hitting that front shoulder. Or square, you know, you're on a moose or something and you just dead nuts square up on a thick rib. You got to plan for that, because that's, you know, if that does happen and you're trying to push too aggressive of a broadhead, too big of a cutting diameter, too steep of a blade angle, that's, you know, you're not going to get any penetration and you're not going to find that animal.
Yeah. I thought of this before and forgot to ask, and this may or may not be related to penetration, but I want to ask now before I forget, and then we'll definitely come back to penetration. You mentioned blade angle. We talked about, you know, short and steep blades as well. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, with the testing that you've done, with what you've looked at with developing solid, what are your thoughts on blade profiles, meaning straight angle versus like, you know, a concave style angle? You know, solid had a bit of that rounded profile with it, that slicing style cut.
Mm-hmm.
We see some blades on the market today with like a convex cut. We see some that are straight with two separate angles. So there's all these different like kind of shapes,
right,
to the broadhead cutting surface. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, it's funny. When I was doing solid, I was just literally online on Google typing in like effective, you know, the most effective knives and swords and stuff like that. And when it purely comes to slicing through something, like a samurai sword is like hands down the most superior, right? Like, because there's always a curve in the blade and there's never a blunt portion hitting something, right? Like if you take a knife and you go to slice through cheese, if you're just trying to like take the whole blunt edge of the knife and just push it through, that's going to be a lot harder than if you start up in the upper corner and have the knife at a blade angle and just push it through, right? It's just going to slice right through. So yeah, that curved edge is just always constantly slicing instead of trying to push through something. and it just it makes a huge difference on penetration, and just how fast and efficiently it cuts. So that it's very, very hard to do, right? You can imagine in a machining process that a curved edge is just a lot harder to machine and get very sharp versus a flat edge. So that's why you're not going to see near as many of them on the market. There are a few. They're generally going to be a little bit more expensive than one with a straight edge. I don't know. I think it's a nice design aspect, and if all things being equal, I would choose it, but it's not probably like the highest priority on the list. And you know, not too recently, but it's definitely becoming more and more popular is just a single bevel versus a double bevel. I think, you know, some guys are huge fans of single. So basically if, it's a flat, completely flat side on edge on one side, and then the other side that's just, I'm trying to think of how to best to describe that, but basically it's just sharpened from one side. So it's completely flat on the back side of the blade, and on the front side of the blade is where the angle of the edge is. The thought there is that basically helps spin your arrow. So as it's flying through the air, as it's cutting through the animal, it's spinning and creating more of a wound channel. I think that's kind of along the same lines of blade shape. It's nice to have, but you know, not necessary.
Yeah. Man, it'd be so cool to be able to see how the spin of an arrow is affected. Like, how much is that slowed down upon contact with an animal? So right. I think in my head, when I picture an arrow impacting going through an animal, I'm always thinking a bit more like straight line, like it's just going through. I'm not thinking that it continues the corkscrew, the spin that it had in flight. It would be so interesting to see mm-hmm. how much of that slows down, like really how much rotation is there, say on a full pass through, you know, through yeah. a deer. That would be so yep. super cool to,
yeah.
to see.
Yeah, I've got this. One of my favorite broadhead targets, just because they're cheap and they last a decent amount of time, is I think it's American Whitetail makes it. It's called the Cube. And how the foam lays out in there, it doesn't matter what broadhead I shoot. If you really pay attention to when you're pulling that arrow out of the target, don't just grab it and yank it out of there. It will rotate.
Mm-hmm.
So as it's cutting into that foam, it is continuing that rotation. Usually it's, you know, not that much, like a quarter to a half of a rotation of the arrow, but it's still going into that foam. It is still continuing that rotation of flight that it had through the air.
Cool. So we talked, I guess penetration, we mentioned previously surface area can affect that, of course. The ferrule design, how that leads the way for the arrow certainly affects that. Certainly the sharpness, the cutting capability of the broadhead can affect that. What else goes into penetration? Anything specific that we should highlight there?
Yeah, I mean, just the obvious of like how many blades you're trying to push through it, 2-blade, 3-blade, 4-blade. And there's also there's also blade stiffness. You can argue like a big, heavy, like say a 060 thick blade. It's going to be more of like a blunt, hard hitting something. There's a lot of blades out there like a 027, so like more of those replaceable razor blade styles, and there's definitely an argument, hard to prove one way or the other, but that blade does have some flex to it, so if you hit a rib, it has the ability to possibly like bend and flex around the rib instead of trying to go through it. And so that's definitely something to kind of, I mean, it's kind of a, you just got to go with what your gut and what you think is going to be the best scenario for you. But I think you'll see sometimes you'll hear stories of a guy say like they shot an animal, maybe like basically broadside, but slightly quartering, and one very stiff blade hits a rib, right? Like the two blades are, say it's a 3-blade broadhead, and two of the blades are like clear of the rib going in between the ribs, but one of them hits it, that it actually takes the arrow and kicks it sideways, and it ends up coming out like the neck. And I haven't experienced that. I've heard stories of that. I think that's, you know, it's one more scenario to play out in your head. That's definitely something that could happen. So yeah, just said, I mean, to me, it's there's this factor of what animal am I hunting? What distances am I shooting? And like, you know, along with fletching, like what is the minimum I need to kill the animal without impacting my penetration? And it's different for like, for a black bear here in Idaho, I prefer to shoot like a big four blade through them, because you need a big hole to get a good blood trail through those things. And I know if I'm hunting over a bait or something like that, it's going to be a 25, 30 yard shot. If I'm going elk hunting in an open country and I'm going to have a lot of 50, 60 yard shots, then that's a different broadhead decision.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a great point. So blade width, the thickness of the blade, something I wanted to chat a bit about, and you mentioned kind of, the diversion factor, maybe that it can kind of sneak around things or have enough material there to kind of punch through. Does that affect anything else? I mean, because I'm thinking like with, you know, keep coming back to solid or mention some of the replaceable blades in general, like those are two very, very different approaches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very different approaches. And part of that, obviously, with something like a solid that's non-replaceable blades, I mean, you have a durability factor there as well. And then you also have, just in general, always keep in mind that given the design, you're always shooting for a weight target. So you always have a play with how much material you're going to have on this broadhead, given its design, to meet a specific weight. So, you know, obviously mm-hmm. the weight could be in the blades, it can be in the ferrule, you balance that out, but... blade width is a super interesting one when you look at it. You know, the numbers you mentioned earlier, they don't sound that far apart, maybe like the 060 or the 027, things like that. But man, you pick up some broadheads and some just feel freaking thick and stout, which seems, you know, really great from a durability perspective. And then you have these others that are just, you know, seemingly razor thin, incredibly sharp. And just seemed so nasty, you know, in terms of cutting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, in general, the replaceable razor blade styles, like I could be wrong. I guess I haven't really paid too much attention the last few years, but like a 040 is probably as thick as you're going to get. I think that's probably a manufacturing, issue, right? The machines just can't get much thicker than that. The benefit, is that you can just swap the blades out, right? I mean, that's why they became so popular. So you practice a bunch, you shoot them into targets, and they get dull. They get dull fast. You know, they're a relatively cheap steel, a cheap metal that they use, and it's a very sharp, fine edge. So it doesn't take much to dull that. So I would absolutely have three or four practice broadheads. You shoot those. I would not... when I was shooting them, I would just take my number one arrow. I'd unscrew the broadhead. I'd replace the blades. I'd keep the same ferrule with that number one arrow, because I knew, going back to spinning and alignment and all that stuff, that everything was good with that specific arrow and broadhead. Swap the blades out. Then I would shoot it one more time. I hated doing it, because I knew I was going to dull the blade a little bit. But you have to, right? You gotta shoot that and make sure that everything got realigned correctly and it's good. So shoot it one more time, put it in the quiver, and then not touch it until it's, you know, you go to pull the arrow out of the quiver to run through an animal. Yeah. So like 040 and down, that's when you're going to see those replaceable blades. There's definitely some advantages to that. Like I said, the sharpness is a huge one, and then you don't have to resharpen anything. The disadvantages, in general, they're not going to be as tough as one that's more of a machined steel. You know, there's plenty of examples out there of ones that are that way, like a G5 Montec. That's actually like a cast molded piece. The solids are machined out of, you know, the main blade is just machined out of what I did was a very high quality steel, so that the blade retention, the edge retention, lasted a lot longer than a cheaper steel, and it makes a significant difference. There's less resharpening, but you still have to resharpen. You can also look at cost along those same lines. Replaceable blades, they're great, but every year you buy three or four packs of replaceable blades, right? Then it costs you $10 or $20. If you buy a broadhead that you have to resharpen yourself, there's no extra cost once you have that initial purchase, just your time to make sure things stay sharp. So other than benefits, like I said, I think it's pretty arguable, and probably every situation could call for a different broadhead that would perform well. You know, like,
yeah,
if you had a again, going back to like hit and bone, like if you had a three blade broadhead with really thin, brittle blades that were razor sharp, and you got a moose standing there at 40 yards and you shoot and the one blade catches a rib, maybe it shatters, but the other two blades go through the animal. I think that's going to end up in a dead moose. If you had in that exact same scenario, if you had a very thick, stout blade, and you're trying to maybe push, maybe you didn't have a lot of kinetic energy momentum behind your arrow, and you that blade just got stuck in the rib, right? And then the rest of the arrow and broadhead just stopped. So, you know, it's so tough. You got to pick, like, you got to pick your battles and just do something, find a broadhead that you feel confident in, I think is pretty critical. That way, you know, when you're full draw, you're not worried about what the broadhead is going to do, but every situation probably calls for a different head.
So you mentioned steel. That's obviously can be, you know, you can totally geek out on just steel alone. I mean, there's so many, you know, like knife guys, for example, who just go crazy and get into, you know, the differences of Rockwell hardness and advantages and steels and super steels and balancing, you know, the edge retention and durability. And obviously hardness is great, but it can get so hard it's brittle. I mean, you can totally geek out on steel, but in general, what are some things to look for if you're going with this higher dollar, non-replaceable, you know, fixed broadhead? You know, you were using S30V with solid. What kind of led you to that when you were years ago now doing that research? Because that was a new deal at the time, really.
There definitely, you know, forever. There was your popular blade knife steel that, you know, that you'd see on a Buck knife or a Gerber knife, and it's like a 440C. It's been 6 or 7 years now since I really dove into all this stuff. But you kind of have your general cheaper tool steels, and then you've got these high end, like high performance stuff. So S30V was developed by a company called Crucible Metals, and it was really doing some crazy cool stuff on breaking down and getting very fine particles that they then basically put back together or, you know, melt into the steel. So if you look at like an S30V, like under a microscope, you can Google all this stuff, that it's going to be a very, very fine, like it's going to look like a lot of grains of sand all aligned perfectly. And then a cheaper steel, it's going to look like big rocks inside there when you're looking through it, you know, through a microscope. And so at the end, that translates into the edge of your blade. You know, you could basically, like, you know, exaggerate it. It's going to feel like sandpaper if you ran your fingernail over it versus like a glass tabletop, right? Like it's going to be very, very smooth. So the benefit of that very smooth edge is that as you're shooting through it, there's nothing like kind of sticking out from the edge that can get broken off and chip away. And this is on a microscopic level, but it makes a huge difference. So a cheaper steel as you shoot, is going to get dull very fast, 'cause all those little edges and bumps in the blade are just breaking off. Where a high quality steel is not going to do that. So as far as, there's a lot of new steels that have been popping up in the last 5 years, a little bit of research I've done. There's a S35VN, D2, which is like a good hardy steel. There's a lot. So, in general, you're probably going to see, if someone wonders why, you know, two broadheads look pretty similar in design and one costs $50 and one costs $100, they're probably going to have a lot nicer steel in that, because the steel is a majority of the cost of the broadhead. So, you kind of get what you pay for. The Rockwell hardness is a whole different thing. Basically, once the steel is machined or is in the plate form before it gets cut, it's going to go through different processes of heating and cooling to develop a different hardness to it. The harder the edge, the harder the steel, the longer the edge lasts, but also in general, the more brittle it becomes. So like S30 will not bend. That is either that broadhead's going to be like look brand new on the other side of the animal, or it's going to be broken. That's kind of one of the downsides to it. It takes an extreme scenario to break it, but it can happen. And so that's a give and take there as well, right? Like, it's, do you want edge retention and a super sharp edge passing all the way through the animal with the chance of it being brittle, or do you want a soft steel that the edge, by the time it comes out the other side of the animal, might be dull? And that's a whole nother topic, right? Like, yeah. Edge retention, and as it comes in the elk, what does it look like coming out of the elk? And, you know, is it even possible for an edge to dull that fast? And it kind of actually is, depending on where you hit, if you hit bone and stuff like that. So, yeah, there's, you can go down a wormhole. There's so many things you can kind of geek out on, but
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Just, I would look for, you know, I'd stay away from something cheaper, and look for like more high quality steels if you're looking in that market. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, it's worth noting too, that we're always thinking blade when we think of broadhead materials, but equally as important is that ferrule. You know, I mean, there's, unfortunately, I've seen them, I've shot them and have bad luck with them in years past. There's ferrules out there where they're using aluminums that just aren't as strong. And obviously, as you think of that ferrule, it's connecting with the arrow, it's holding the blades. And if stuff goes wrong there, like if that gets out of whack or slightly bent, I mean, it can have crazy effects downrange. Yep. So it's also, you know, don't, like, yes, obviously look at the blades, but man, none come to mind, but I've shot them in the past. I can't even remember what the heck it was, but it had pretty solid blades. They stayed together well, they were sharp, all that, but man, that aluminum ferrule was just no bueno.
As a general rule, I would not buy a broadhead with an aluminum ferrule.
Yeah.
It's gonna bend, unless the design of it is how the blades interlock. And I mean, there's some ways you could design around it, but as a general rule, I would look for steel.
So let's come back. Let's maybe wrap up with this, but like in anything else, something I always look at, consider really with any kind of gear category, is simplicity, which leads to so many things often, such as durability, and then obviously ease of use. You know, for example, there's been replaceable blade, fixed blade broadheads that I freaking love the way they fly. I love how sharp they are. But they're a freaking pain in the butt, the way that the blades interlock, or there's no like containment ring on them. So as soon as you unthread one from an arrow, it's freaking falling apart in your hands, which is always awesome when you're dealing with razor blades.
Yeah.
So just what about simplicity? I mean, is that a factor for you with broadheads?
Yeah, absolutely. I think any broadhead that if you unscrew it from the arrow, the broadhead falls apart, that scares the crap out of me. I don't want to mess with that. Like, I know, like, I just got back from Texas and I had my solids, and, you know, I had my number one arrow, my number one broadhead, to travel with throughout my bow case. I unscrewed the broadhead, you know, I knew which one was which, how I put them in the case. I knew what broadhead belonged to what arrow. And I was able to screw it back together and be good to go. Right. If you had, a replaceable blade, you pull that, you screw the broadhead out, or not a replaceable blade, but one where you said that the blade retention is based on it being screwed into the arrow. Then you pull that apart, the whole broadhead falls apart. You got to reassemble it all. You know, that's a little bit more worrisome to me. So I'm not a fan of those ones just for many, many reasons. I think it's even more than possible for, like, you know, it's how often do you have to tighten your field point back up or your broadhead back up once you screw it into the end of the arrow? There's definitely a scenario you could be out in the field and that could come just slightly loose, and you go to shoot and you got a wobbly blade flying through the air. So, and that's not going to be good. A work around that is just put a little bit of string wax on the threads before you screw that broadhead in, and that'll help. But still, it's something I would avoid if I, you know, could.
Yeah. Absolutely. Anything else that comes to mind, Steve? I think we've definitely covered some good ground here without, you know, diving off into super deep areas that we obviously could get into or get into discussions on comparing a bunch of different models, which is, you know.
I guess, as general rules, like I said, pay attention to the surface area and the aerodynamics of the broadhead. Like, I think it's very, you know, our culture has got this mentality that bigger is better. And guys, you know, there's broadheads on the market that I just like, I see come out and I just shake my head, right? They got like a freaking big old fixed blade on the front and like a 3-inch mechanical blade that comes off the back. And I mean, I'm just, you know, I don't know what to do but shake my head. But guys see that and they go, oh, cool. I'm going to, you know, it's going to throw a freaking axe through the animal as it's flying through the air.
Yeah.
And that's like, you know, I don't know. So just pay attention to the aerodynamics of it. Make sure its build quality is good. So steel ferrule, you know, good sharp blades. Stay away from aluminum, I think, in the ferrule is a general rule. And then, yeah, make sure, you know, if you are buying, you know, quote unquote cheaper broadheads, if they're $30 for a 3-pack or cheaper, you know, make sure you're spinning those because there's probably more of a chance. Those are things that are just getting cranked out and mass produced. Make sure that you're spinning those and you spin all of every broadhead, but that there's not one that's misaligned and wobbly. Yeah, I think that's it. And then just, you know, it's know your limitations, know what you're hunting, know the distances you're going to be shooting, because I think all of those are factors that play into your broadhead decision. If you're hunting whitetails and it's 20 yards out of your tree stand, I think you've got a lot more margin for error there. But if you're coming out west and you're going to go do an early season high country mule deer hunt and, you know, 60, 70 yard shots are pretty stinking common, you better have a broadhead that flies really well, has a small surface area. So if there's a crosswind or something like that, and it's got to penetrate, you know, if you hit that deer's shoulder at 60 yards. So, yeah, that's kind of, yeah, definitely a synopsis of all the things I would be looking for.
Perfect. Well, if you guys are wondering more about broadhead flight, want to get into kind of the arrow building aspect of that, some of the bow tuning aspects of that, stay tuned next week. We spoke with Darren Cooper as a follow-up with this episode. It was a great discussion, so you definitely don't want to miss that. And then if there's things that we didn't cover, I know there's things we didn't cover partly on purpose, but if you guys have questions, you know, go ahead and shoot us an email to podcast@xmonger.com. If nothing else, we'll kind of get answers for those questions on a future Q&A episode, if not dive off into a whole nother level of broadhead geekiness for those questions, if that's what you guys want to hear. Thanks so much for tuning in, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely stay tuned for that one with Darren. That was a great episode. He had a very, like, no-nonsense, no BS approach to tuning, and I loved it.
Well, that's a wrap on this one. You guys be sure to tune in next week as we get into deeper on broadhead flight, on arrows, vane selection, bow tuning, all that good stuff. Darren Cooper is a wizard. We're excited to have him on the show. As always, you can go to xomountaingear.com/podcast to make sure that you're subscribed or to see past episodes. You can send us your feedback directly by email to podcast@xomountaingear.com. And if you're enjoying the show, we would love to see a review in iTunes, on Stitcher, or wherever else you might be listening to this. Catch you next week.